Hey everyone, this is Dominic Inyer with a quick pre-program announcement. The BEL Telethon is back. In the past, we've set goals like $30,000 or $40,000, but this time we're looking for some more long-term security. Being on air isn't cheap. We do about 20 shows a month, and they run us about $150 a broadcast. So we're looking for 20 new donors to sponsor one show a month. We operate on a shoestring budget, so in the past, we've relied heavily on those large dollar telethons and big donations. The success of this telethon is crucial. Not only would it mean we're able to continue getting Bob's biblical teachings out to our current audience, but bring his content and legacy to thousands more. The ministries of many godly leaders, authors, and pastors have been magnified tenfold or even a hundredfold after their passing. I think of C.S. Lewis and how he, still today, has such an impact for the Lord on millions. We have no doubt that Bob could have a similar impact. Security would help us to make Bob's content more available to the masses and drive our ministry to further honor and glorify God. So go to kgov.com and click sponsor a show. Maybe you could sponsor one show, half a show, a third of a show, or even two shows. Who knows? Now, if you want me to shut up so you can get back to listening to Bob, help us reach our goal and I'll get out of your way. But I will keep coming back to pester you, so help us reach that goal and then I will get out of your way. Anyways, now here is my predecessor, mentor, teacher, and father, Bob Inyer, with Theology Thursday. This show is sponsored by an anonymous BEL supporter.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Inyer, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. This is Theology Thursday. Typically, we look at the news of the day from a Christian worldview. Today, we look at the source of the Christian worldview, God's Word.
Ruth chapter 3. It's not lengthy at all, so we can be more leisurely and do a better job at illustrating concepts in the chapter and getting background material. And even at that, because it's such a short chapter, we'll likely have a short study. Elimelech and his only two sons are now dead. Would any member of his family have the right and the inclination to save his family name from extinction and to redeem his land? In chapter 3, we will read of Naomi's plan to get her husband's land redeemed through the Mosaic law of the kinsman redeemer. The kinsman redeemer. That law symbolizes Christ's role as man's redeemer. Christ became our kinsman. He became one of us. He became flesh and dwelt among us, and he became one of our brothers. He's not our closest relative, so to speak. We have closer kinsmen than Christ, for humanly speaking, he was of the flesh through his mother Mary, but his father is God. So in a sense, in that human way of looking at it, he is our half-brother. That is, not the nearest kinsman, but close enough to do the job of redemption. And he was the only kinsman willing and able to redeem us, taking upon himself everything which that job entailed. Please turn to Leviticus 25. In our study of Ruth 3, we're starting out in Leviticus 25 because we want to find out what is a kinsman redeemer. As Christians who study the Bible, we understand somewhat the idea of redemption. Mankind is lost in sin. Christ paid the price and thereby purchased salvation for those who repent. So he is the redeemer, and through him men have redemption. So what is a kinsman redeemer? Well, the Jews, as a general rule, but with exceptions, were not allowed to permanently sell their land because the land belonged to God. Effectively, he was leasing it to them. Leviticus 25, 23. The land shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine, for you are strangers and sojourners with me. And in all the land of your possession, you shall grant redemption of the land. If one of your brethren becomes poor and has sold some of his possession, and if his redeeming relatives come to redeem it, then he may redeem what his brother sold. A relative is a kinsman. Thus, the kinsman redeemer, one of the popular titles of Christ, our kinsman redeemer. And the land, by the way, is often used as a symbol for the people of the land. Symbolically, redeeming the land is like redeeming the people of the land. God repeatedly uses that figure, even though Jason may dispute it. Jason and I have an ongoing debate over what is truly symbolic and what's just a stretch. In the Bible, God uses this metaphor commonly to refer to people, and often God's people, like in Joel chapter 3. They have divided up my land, they have cast lots for my people. You see how land and people are used as synonyms? Joel chapter 2, the Lord will be zealous for his land and pity his people. In Numbers 35, no atonement can be made for the land. Well, God wasn't shedding blood for an atonement for the land, but for the people of the land. One passage states, and I don't have the reference here handy, perhaps I could find it later in the study. It says, the land has committed great harlotry. Well, the land has committed harlotry? The land has committed fornication? It's a figure of speech. Have I convinced you, Jason? Okay. That the land is a figure for the people. In the plot, chapter 3, we list another 12 examples. You can check that out. Of such symbolic use of the land referring to the people. Thus, redeeming the land symbolically refers to redeeming the people. And these are God's people. These are God's people. So, the message of Ruth is, do not sell them permanently into bondage because he plans on redeeming them from whichever taskmaster they have placed themselves under. Now back to Leviticus 25. In verse 23, we saw, don't sell the land permanently. Verse 24, if the land is sold, allow it to be redeemed. Verse 25, permit a kinsman redeemer to purchase the land. Now continuing, or if the man has no one to redeem it, but he himself becomes able to redeem it, then let him count the years since its sale and restore the remainder to the man to whom he sold it, that he may return to his possession. Now, what does that mean? If he was poor, he sold his land, now he's made some money, he's worked hard, and now he has to count the years until the Jubilee and return an appropriate amount. Well, every 50 years, any land that was sold in Israel would revert back to the original owner, to the original tribe and the family within the tribe. God had a goal of keeping stable ownership of the land in Israel. So when people bought farmland in Israel, it was basically a lease. And it was a lease until the next Jubilee. The Jubilees were every 50 years. It's somewhat similar to homeowners in Hawaii where they don't own the land. It's leased from the government. And they, you know, when the lease is up, if your father, your grandfather entered into the lease, when it's up, maybe you won't get it renewed. So it's a strange deal. It's a bad deal in Hawaii. Imagine that a man from Judah sold 100 acres to another Israelite in the tribe of Zebulun. So he sells 100 acres to this guy from Zebulun, and he sells it for 100 pieces of silver. And then he goes off, and he needed the money, but then he acquired money, and he comes back, and he wants to buy the land back. And it's now 10 years later. So 10 years later, and let's say the Jubilee, when he sold the land, the Jubilee was 20 years away, yet future. Now it's 10 years later, he had sold the land to this guy for 100 pieces of silver. It's now 10 years later, the Jubilee will be in 10 years, so the guy's gotten like half of his money's worth. So if this man from Judah can come up with 50 pieces of silver, he can force a sale to return the land to himself by the law. And God had, while there seemed to be perhaps some exceptions, God had basically told Israel not to charge interest. Don't charge interest, especially to the poor. But then you can charge interest to foreigners, but don't charge interest to your own nation, your own people within Israel. That's how a kinsman would redeem the land, or a person himself would redeem the land. Now, continuing in verse 28, but if he is not able to have it restored to himself, then what was sold shall remain in the hand of him who bought it until the year of Jubilee. And in the Jubilee it shall be released, and he shall return to his possession. If a man sells a house in a walled city. Now this is interesting, and this here helps us determine that this law is not an absolute moral law. It's not absolute spiritual truth, but it's symbolic. It's symbolic and cultural. We read in verse 29, if a man sells a house in a walled city, then he may redeem it within a whole year after it is sold. Within a full year, he may redeem it. It's like a real estate pawn shop. You pawn your home and you get 12 months to buy it back, if it's in the city. Verse 30, but if it is not redeemed within the space of a full year, then the house in the walled city shall belong permanently to him who bought it. Throughout his generations, it shall not be released in the Jubilee. Now, so we can tell that this is a symbolic ordinance, because if it was absolute morality, then you'd just have to go through the difficulty of keeping track of the homes in the city. But an urban area is different than a rural area. And in the countryside, where your tribe got this, you know, 400 square miles is your tribe, and you divided it up by families, it's not just your neighbors, they're your relatives. And people know one another. And even the people down in the valley next door and beyond that next hill, they know one another. And life doesn't change all that rapidly in an agrarian society. And so by the time the Jubilee came up, even if somebody had sold their land, moved away and died, the neighbors would all know who the land belonged to. Whereas in a city, sometimes you don't even know your neighbors. And the Jubilee hits, and the people in that part of town, they've been there 5 years, 15, 20 years. They don't know 50 years earlier who that house belonged to. So it's more complicated. And of course, they could have kept records, as they did, but there were, you know, roaming hordes who would burn down cities, and they didn't have what the government has today, an off-site backup program for catastrophic failures, and just have your computer tapes restored. They didn't have that back then. So there was this exception to the rule that redeeming, being able to redeem your property, did not apply in the cities.
Stop the tape, stop the tape. It's Dominic Anyar coming back to pester you yet again and deprive you from this incredible Theology Thursday teaching and remind you about our telethon. We are looking for 20 sponsors to help sponsor one show every month to give us the security we need to promote the gospel and Bob's teaching and reach thousands more. So go to kgov.com, kgov.com, and either click the banner at the top of the website or click sponsor a show. If you want me to shut up so you can go back to listening to Bob, go ahead and sponsor a show, and that will help to get me to shut up even quicker. This show is sponsored by an anonymous BEL supporter. Now, back to Bob.
So there was this exception to the rule that redeeming, being able to redeem your property, did not apply in the cities. And what is this symbolic regulation supposed to teach? What kind of spiritual truth? Well, God has not forgotten about man, and God plans to redeem man. Back then, it was still future. Now we look back in history to when Christ died for us. Christ was born right out about, as best we can tell, right around the year 4000 AM, Anno Mundi, of the year of the world, when the earth was created, about 4000 years later, Christ was born. Almost exactly 1000 years after David took Jerusalem as his capital, and then it would have been 1000 years almost exactly after Christ rose from the dead that he would have been sitting on a throne in a 1000-year kingdom. There were parallels here, some symmetry with time that God seemed to be interested in. And so perhaps the 4000 years until Christ was born, that would have been from the foundation of the earth, the 80th Jubilee. The 80th Jubilee, the number 5, often in the Bible, symbolizing grace, and then number 8, eternity. And so God would not forget about man, but be determined to redeem man through Christ. And the last verse in Leviticus 25, we'll look at 31. However, the houses of the villages, which have no wall around them, shall be counted as the fields of the country. They may be redeemed, and they shall be released in the Jubilee. So if your family sells a home in the city, it's gone forever if they haven't redeemed it in the first 12 months. But if you sell a farmhouse in the countryside, you may redeem it along with your fields prior to the Jubilee. Naomi's husband, Elimelech, owned land around Bethlehem. And when things were tough during a famine, he sold out and moved to Moab. Now, more than 10 years had passed, the Jubilee was still yet sometime in the future, and since the economy had improved, Naomi devised a plan to use this law of the land, this Mosaic law, find a kinsman redeemer who would repurchase her husband's land. That's the setting as we get to Ruth chapter 3. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, Ruth's mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, shall I not seek security for you, that it may be well with you?" And these questions at the beginning of chapter 3 are themselves a figure of speech. They're rhetorical, not expecting an answer, just making a point. No? Yes. "Shall I not seek security for you?" Yes, of course I shall. "Now Boaz, whose young women you were with, his maidservants, is he not our relative?" Yes, he's our relative. Of course, Ruth wouldn't have firsthand knowledge of this since she was a Moabite who had married into the family in another land. But in fact, in verse 2, "he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor." He's winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Now, that's not something we're real familiar with these days. I grew up in New Jersey, the Garden State, and I never saw a cow until I was like 15 or so. Winnowing, well, it means to separate the chaff from the grain. And how do you do it? You could separate it by hand. You could break it up and take the grain out and put it in a box or something, in a bowl. But that would be very labor intensive. Since the chaff was real light, you'd break it apart through different means and then use the wind or a fan, a winnowing fan or a breeze, to blow the chaff away. And then the wheat you would collect on the floor, on the threshing floor. And the chaff would also be all around your work area. Often in the evening, after a warm day harvesting, well, whether you harvest or not, often after a warm day, a breeze will blow in the evening, and that breeze was taken advantage of, typically, by harvesters. It still is today in places around the world. Boaz was the master, but it was typical and remained so for many centuries until even of late for the master to help in the threshing. He wouldn't do the harvesting or the bundling or the transporting. His servants would do that. But he would be there on the threshing floor doing the work and supervising the work. And if they had to, they'd use a winnowing fan, a handheld fan. And they'd use a stick and beat it, and the chaff would fall and would blow aside, and then they would collect the grain. Now, what's the chaff? Well, it's that on barley or different grains, it's the dry, flaky, or even scaly enclosure around the wheat itself. It encloses the mature grain of wheat. And so that's what you'd want to be blown away. Now, these ideas are all significant symbols in the Bible. The threshing floor, the winnowing fan, the chaff, and the wheat. Since they're so significant, let's take a little bit of time and get a sampling of their use. Psalm 1 contrasts the steadfast man who is planted and shall not be moved with the man that is blown by the winds. Psalm 1, the man who delights in the Lord shall be like a tree planted by the rivers, deep roots, sturdy, unmovable. The ungodly are not so, but are like the chaff which the wind drives away. Therefore, the ungodly shall not stand in judgment. And we could see how that figure applies so readily to spiritual matters. Likewise, from Isaiah chapter 5, verse 20, woe to those who call evil good and good evil. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes. Woe to men who justify the wicked for a bribe. Therefore, as the fire devours the stubble and the flame consumes the chaff, so their root will be as rottenness, because they have rejected the law of God. So the flame consumes the chaff. Boaz would have had a fire burning late that afternoon. They would have been harvesting all day, and they'd have a stack of grain in sheaves, and then they would take it and beat it, crush it, beat it with a stick, and the breeze or the winnowing fan, and the chaff that collected, they would burn that, and that's a typical symbol in the Bible, the wicked burning like the chaff, God burning them. The chaff is burned in the fire, and the wheat is kept in the storehouse. And that agricultural term, winnow, a winnow is used by extension to mean getting rid of undesirable parts, to examine closely and separate the good from the bad. So John the Baptist used this figure of speech in Matthew 3. He said that God's winnowing fan is in his hand, and he will thoroughly clean out his threshing floor and gather his wheat into the barn, but he will burn up the chaff with unquenchable fire. So he will thoroughly clean his threshing floor. As you're doing this work, you could tell everything gets a mess. You know, so he's going to send his workers to sweep up and don't miss one bit of chaff, but burn it. But he's going to take care of the wheat, which is those who respond to the seed, the word of God. And Job said in chapter 21 that the wicked are like straw before the wind and like chaff that a storm carries away. And in Hosea, speaking of idolaters, they shall be like the morning cloud and like the early dew that passes away, like chaff blown off from a threshing floor and like smoke from a chimney. That's the wicked. And smoke from a chimney, that last image works well for me. It lingers for a brief moment and it's gone. And so too will be God's enemies. They're causing trouble right now, but very briefly, it'll be over. Don this morning, Don is 73, and he said he remembers when he was in Japan when he was 19, and 54 years passed like that, he said. And I concur. I'm 41, but the last 54 years of my life passed just like that. I mean, it's quick. I remember high school as though it were yesterday. And every day, it's just last week we were talking about the Deanovics coming over for lunch. And they were going to have lunch at our house this past week on Wednesday, I think it was. And I was talking with my boys days before that. And I said, and we were sitting at dinner. I said, now the Deanovics will be here Wednesday at noon. Make sure you're here. I want you to get to meet them. And, well, that's a few days from now. We've got time. Well, that moment will be here like that. You'll pick up your fork to put some food in your mouth, and when you put it back on the plate, it'll be Wednesday lunch. And now that's gone. And it was like that. And they're gone. They're back on the road, headed to Minnesota. And they'll be back out here in a couple weeks to move to attend church here, which we can't wait till they get here. But life flies by, and the wicked are like smoke from a chimney. And the time of their opportunity to fight against God is gone. So I'm looking forward to that. So according to Naomi, Ruth's mother-in-law, her relative Boaz, verse 2, is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. And barley grows, it's native to Israel, and it's a grain used in cereals and other foods. And today, at least, we use it also to feed livestock. Verse 3, therefore, wash yourself and anoint yourself, put on your best garment, and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. And the harvest was a time of feasting. It would be like in business today, if you're on a cycle and the first of the month is when you make all your sales or you get all your paycheck. And you say to your wife, honey, let's go out to dinner. I'm loaded. And so the harvest was the time they collected and they would celebrate. It would be like a feast. And so Naomi said, get ready, get cleaned up, put on your best garment. It'd have to be a warm garment too, because she's going to be out all night. And go down to the threshing floor, but do not make yourself known until he's finished eating and drinking. Now, don't make yourself known. How would she do that? Well, there were a crowd of workers, and that would be the center focal point of their evening at the threshing floor. They too would be eating and drinking, preparing to settle down for the night. And she would be inconspicuous in her warm outer garment and the veil that she wore that we hear about later. Naomi's saying, just melt into the background until a certain time. And Naomi continues, verse 4, then it shall be when he lies down that you shall notice the place where he lies. And you shall go in, uncover his feet, and lie down, and he will tell you what you should do. Now, since the fields were out some distance from town, and since they would work late into the night, and to protect his valuable grain, it was common for the master to sleep in the field at the threshing site. I checked a commentary written in 1929, and it said that peasants of Palestine still sleep out in the open air at threshing time, just as they did thousands of years ago. And Boaz would lie down near the same heap of barley that he had been harvesting. So this concise account we have here in Ruth is not exhaustive. It doesn't tell us every word that was communicated. And sure enough, we can tell that there's part of the instructions that are left out. But regardless, Ruth was very eager to obey all the instructions. And Naomi had said, go in, uncover his feet, and lie down, and he will tell you what you should do. Now, this is not advice I would give to my daughter if I had a daughter, which I don't. Quite the opposite. I'd say, if he tells you to lie down at his feet, I'll break his neck. And even if it's her idea, I'd still break his neck. So to Western minds, this advice sounds indelicate. Obviously, though, there was no immodesty implied. It would grow cool during the night. I recall that the barley harvest was at the end of March, and the workers, now including Boaz, would sleep in their work clothes and outer garments. And some Bible commentators, trying to make sense of this, say that, when sleeping in a master's tent, an Eastern servant would lay crosswise at his feet and warm themselves at the edge of his cloak. And I don't know if that's true or not. Commentators say all kinds of things. But I think that misses the point. I think she was here communicating to him her hope that was instilled in her from Naomi, that he will exercise his right as a kinsman redeemer, redeem the land of her deceased father-in-law, and marry Ruth as part of the package. That's what I think she was offering to him and communicating that desire. She's about to say, we'll read in a couple verses, she's about to say to Boaz, take your maidservant under your wing, for you are a close relative, which is tantamount to a marriage proposal from the woman to the man in this instance, and yes, an older man at that.
Hey, this is Dominic Enyar again reminding you we are looking for 20 new sponsors to help us stay on air and reach thousands more with the gospel, with the truth, and with the teachings of Bob Enyar. If you enjoyed this program and you think it's important that content like this gets out to other Christians, other brothers in the Lord, please consider sponsoring a show, half a show, or even a third of a show. Go to kgov.com, kgov.com, and click sponsor a show. Thank you so much. God bless. This is Dominic Enyart reminding you to do right and risk the consequences.